First, if you spent time in rural areas decades ago, there are probably sounds and particular species that stand out in your memory. But there's a good chance that if you're still there, you go back to visit, you might see and hear fewer of those creatures. It turns out there are a lot of different factors that have made it harder for wildlife and farming to share land together. Our next guest says there's a lot we can do to feed people while still keeping a place for wildlife on and around farmland. John Marsliff is professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington and the author or co-author of several books on environmental topics. His most recent is In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
Well, I want to give a sound to the bird in your title there, an eastern meadowlark. Here's a listen. And that's a bird that is an emblem for a lot of the changes you've seen going on when it comes to wildlife in our agricultural areas. What is it about meadowlarks that stand out for you?
Well, a couple of things. They're pretty much obligate grassland nesters, and at least during the breeding season, that's where we see them up here in North America. Because they're so closely tied to grasslands, their populations have plummeted over the last several decades by up to 70%. By some estimates. So they're a flagship for a species that is in decline in response to the way we've treated our grassland environments.
And growing up looking at farmland all the time, the change that's happened may not stand out to us. Can you talk about, over the last couple of centuries, how we've changed our grassland ecosystems around the United States?
Sure. And first, I think your point that these changes don't stand out so strongly to us is a good one. And the meadowlark's an example of that as well. You probably, most listeners have probably still heard or seen meadowlarks in the past years, but their numbers are greatly reduced. And that's because we've done things like plowed up an awful lot of the prairie and planted it with cereal crops. And in the upper Midwest, that's mostly corn and soybean as we get a little further south as well. So the change in that perennial grass to a annual cereal grain that's harvested and disturbed each year has reduced the ability of birds to nest in that environment.
And you say, you write that even within agriculture in North America, we've had that change to that monoculture, these huge crops. In the past, was it more possible for wildlife, not just the meadowlark, but other species to survive on and around American farmland?
I would say it wasn't even more possible. It was exactly the norm there. When we had smaller farms, we had hedgerows between them. We had waterways and ponds that were left. Places that were difficult to work just weren't worked. And that was good for wildlife. They could find shelter there. There was less of a human footprint on the land.
But the big contradiction, the difficulty at the core of your book is we've got a lot of people on this planet. We keep having more and more people on the planet. How do we feed them while still leaving room for this kind of wildlife, either to live on our farmland or to live near it? How do you see that struggle shaping up in the 21st century?
I think it's going to be a struggle, and I think it's one of the grand challenges we face as a species. Unless we want to be left alone on this planet with our food, we need to do something to allow other forms of life to exist with us in these settings. And people talk about two basic strategies. The one you referred to of basically intensifying our use of the agricultural land so that we can set aside more natural lands for wildlife. And the other is to share our farmlands, not farm them so intensively, but kind of step back to the way it was in the 60s, 50s, where there was a lighter touch, more natural habitat interspersed with farmland, and a different attitude of farmers to enjoy and look for ways to coexist with the wildlife on their lands.
We're talking to John Marsliff about his new book, In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. And John, I want to make it clear, in your book, you're not making farmers out to be the bad guy here. You see them as people wanting to steward their land, their soil, and their region. And you find a lot of them doing innovative things to make their farming practices more sustainable. Do you see a lot of hope coming from farmers themselves to be part of the solutions to the questions you're raising?
I absolutely do. All the farmers that I talk with, and I went to many farms here in the U.S. and Costa Rica, and in all of those cases, the farmers I met were enthusiastic about the animals and native plants on their lands. But they're faced with an economic challenge of making a living. And to do so in some settings requires them basically to work the land in a way that's not as conducive to wildlife as it once was. But they all look for ways to do it, and I found many very innovative, as you say, strategies to do so.
You point toward past success stories in dealing with challenges to the way we farm, and one is the reaction to the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, where farming practices were changed in kind of one of the agricultural heartlands of the United States to resist future droughts. Does that inspire you that as big as the challenges are, there is hope today?
Well, I think whenever we face those sorts of challenges, we do tend to rise to the occasion and innovate our way out of it. And I'm hopeful that we will continue to do that. It's more difficult when we're also trying to do that and conserve species that perhaps some feel are not so necessary for our being. I don't see it that way, but that makes it a more difficult situation than just growing more food for more people. But the Dust Bowl saw lots of conservation efforts put into place to save topsoil, to reduce its loss from wind, and that included planting of trees, leaving some unplowed areas, reducing tilling in general. All of those things are beneficial for the health of the land and for the wildlife that depends on it.
You look to a lot of people and institutions for solutions here. One of those groups is the consumer, people who eat food, which is, I guess, all of us. What kind of things would you invite people who eat food to think about when it comes to supporting this kind of sustainability?
Yeah, I think we can all play an important part here. And one of the first things I'd ask you to think about is, who's your farmer? Do you know them? Have you met them? Do you know how they treat their land and how they treat it with respect to harboring wildlife? I met a woman whose dad is a banana picker in Costa Rica, and I will only buy organic bananas now because of the stories from him of being doused with pesticides while he was working in the field of traditional big ag down there. So knowing the sorts of stresses that are on the farmer, how they cope with them, that can point us to buying certain types of food. And in general, one of the most important things we can do is think carefully about our choice of meat, especially. It has a huge effect on the environment, from climate change to the crops that are grown that are fed to our cattle in particular. So, again, from my standpoint, the more we can do to wean ourselves from grain-fed beef, the better we can do for the environment as well.
And then you look toward creating incentives for farmers with things like a conservation program in the U.S. Farm Bill. What kind of things would you like to see more of?
Yeah, that became very apparent as I talked with farmers that had a choice to put some of their lands into the Conservation Reserve Program or other sorts of programs like that that allows them to fallow land or to plant it in ways that are more conducive to wildlife. They simply can't afford to do that. They make a lot less per acre than they would if they planted it in soy or corn. So rectifying that, paying for conservation and making it a fair trade to conserve versus to harvest the area is, I think, critical. And those of us who have a voice in our governing bodies should try to make that pitch strongly to them.
We're talking to ornithologist John Marsliff. He's a professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington. We're talking about his new book. It's called In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you live in a farming area, have you seen over time this decline in the number of particular kinds of birds or animals that used to be maybe more present on farmland in Wisconsin? If you're a farmer yourself, do you try to keep your farm friendly to wildlife in one way or another? If so, how? What would help you to do that? Do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk now with John Marsliff, professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington. His new book is called In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you be willing to pay a little more for food that you know is raised in a way that supports wildlife? How about reducing the amount of corn-fed meat that you eat? If you're a farmer, what incentives or support would help you to be able to steward your land in a way that encourages wildlife conservation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Chris is with us in Adams. Chris, hi.
Hi. I was living out on a farm that was in the middle of big-time soy and corn production, and we were getting dived by my chemicals every hour of every day during the summer. It was horrible. But I bought a house in the city, and I think that people are living in some kind of despair about what they can do. I bought a house that's on a lot. It's 150 feet by 150 feet. I am digging up every speck of grass on this lot, and I am planting prairie. And I am going to invite this little oasis to be a place where wildlife and pollinators can come and be happy. And I think if everybody that could do that, because there are restrictions on it, but if everybody can do that, it's a little thing that you can do to make yourself feel better about this. You're not like just lost in this huge industrial farming complex that you can't control.
Chris, thanks for the call. John, she's doing it in her lot, but is there room for farmers to create those spaces, whether they're buffer zones or reserve areas, enough to make a difference?
Absolutely. And in at your home is also a great place to start. There's no doubt about that. Every little bit helps. But on the farm, you've got more land to work with. So again, places that are difficult to work, point rows, those little triangles that are hard to get the plow down, leaving those and letting places like that go back to nature. The areas that aren't hit by the irrigation wheels can be places where a little bit of prairie can grow. And some of the birds, the smaller birds like savanna sparrows, can get by in small patches of prairie. Meadowlarks need a little bit larger patch.
Thanks for that call, Chris, at 800-642-1234. Pete emailed us from Reedsburg. Pete says, I'm 65 and grew up in rural Richland County. In those years, birds like meadowlarks, whippoorwills, and red-headed woodpeckers were so common you barely noticed them. Today, Pete says, it's a memorable day when you see or hear even one. On the other hand, Pete says, hawks of all kinds were not very common back then. Today, they're all over the countryside, maybe because we stopped killing them indiscriminately. Shows we can make a difference if we try. What do you think of what Pete had to say, John?
Yeah, actually, it's absolutely right. Hawks have increased, but not the ones that require the grassland, like the northern harrier. That hawk has declined along with the other grassland birds. But with banning of DDT, hawk populations in general have increased greatly, and that's been a boon to that group of birds for sure. And it, as he says, it shows that some simple changes can, even though they seem difficult, imagine banning pesticides like DDT now, that change had profound effects.
Let's go back to our callers. Carlin is with us in Waukesha. Carlin, hi.
Hi. Just want to put in a plug for the monarch butterfly, because I think, the Environmental Defense Fund and everybody, I read information about it. The population has decreased by 90%, and it's the milkweed destruction. And that's where it used to live, was between the fields, the farmers' fields, and along our, along the roadways and everything. And because of herbicides and because of the way the farmers have to farm now, we don't have all that habitat anymore. So they're suffering a lot, and we need to plant more milkweed. So just putting in a plug for that, too, because
Carlin, thanks a lot for the call. I know there's this effort in Wisconsin and elsewhere, John, to get farmers and road departments and homeowners do exactly what Carlin's talking about, bring back those milkweed patches.
Yeah, and a common place was in the ditches along roads, and that's an easy target for conservation, and the verges in the roads even. That's an easy target. It's not one that's being farmed intensively right now, and a little bit of change there could, again, make a big difference.
Thanks for that call, Carlin, at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Willem is on the line in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi, I live in a rural community. I'm surrounded by farms, and I've lived here for 30 years, and I remember when we first moved here, I used to see a lot more meadowlarks and bobolinks and birds that are sort of nesters, grass nesters, but they've started to cut the hay so early these days. So I'm not blaming them. That's probably a necessity on their part. But this early harvesting of hay, the first cutting, is usually before the nesting birds, grass nesting birds, have a chance to fledge and leave the nest. So a lot of them are killed in that process. And then I used to also hear a lot of whippoorwills, and I haven't heard a whippoorwill, I bet you it's been 10 years. And I think that that has to do with the wetland destruction, which is also, you know, wetlands being converted to different types of land use. And the other bird that I've disappeared from seeing very often are red-headed woodpeckers. So there are many birds that are disappearing. It's just that a lot of people either don't notice or, you know, I guess they just don't notice.
Well, thanks for the call. And, John, I wonder sometimes as you're talking to people, do they have that moment like, yeah, I never thought about it. I used to see these guys, these birds all the time. Now I never do.
Yes, all the time. I think, and especially a bird like the bobolink is another great example, like the meadowlark. But the bobolink is a species that kids grew up with 40, 50 years ago. And it was common. It was kind of a herald of spring. And it was looked forward to seeing that bird back. And that's been missing. And in fact, it is because of these early harvests of hay fields and some of the grasslands that are harvested for cattle feed as well. But there are some very innovative programs out there targeting these species, paying farmers to delay their harvest in California and in New England. This is working well. So farmers, again, if we incentivize the right sorts of things, they're more than happy to do this and still are able to make a living. And the bobolinks and other species are able to survive as well.
Willem, thanks for that call. We're talking to John Marsliff. His new book is In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. One thing that struck me in your book, John, I think this is in Nebraska, not just a decline in species diversity, but in the number of humans in farming communities. We hear about rural decline in Wisconsin. I think you were in Nebraska where there were these once thriving, vibrant farming communities. Now they have way fewer people and way less going on thanks to the way agriculture has changed.
Yeah, I went to Ong, Nebraska, a small place that I would never have heard of except that my mother-in-law grew up there as a farm kid. And boy, it was a great place back in the day. As we drove through with her, you could see the life just drained out of her as we looked at the churches that were abandoned, all the abandoned buildings, all the favorite places and memories of her childhood basically had just been left to decay as people have moved to cities, as farms are being owned by fewer and fewer people. Big corporations don't have all the houses on the land that used to be there that supported the smaller individual farmer and the need for these smaller rural towns. So there's a dramatic shift across the middle U.S. for sure.
Let's bring on one more caller. Mary Kay is with us now in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hello.
Hi, I called the DNR last year. The birds and the bees are disappearing because of pesticide applications, toxic pesticide applications. They don't want anything to do with that land. So when we have safer pesticides, which I'm sure the DNR has already issued, we're going to see them come back.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. John, just that direct impact, do we see that of pesticides on the wildlife?
I agree with that. In Nebraska, I plotted that trend out because we measure the number of acres that are treated with pesticides each year in the U.S., and that number has increased dramatically in association with decline of grassland birds. But we have also greatly reduced the amount of habitat out there. So if they're hand in hand, and I agree, safer pesticides, if such a thing exists, would be good. But there's a lot of natural ways to deal with pests. And a lot of the farmers I talked with are employing those, from having bluebirds and owls on their property to eat pests to other sorts of plants that have pesticide benefits.
You refer to a Wisconsinite, Aldo Leopold, a few times in your book, including his charge to remake agriculture in a way that increases the what he called stability, integrity, and beauty of the planet. How do you see that spirit maybe being a guidepost to the future?
I think it'd be the most fantastic guidepost we could have. And I met some farmers here. I thought I was talking to Leopold a few times with the way these people work their land. They really see it as a community, not solely a commodity, which again is an important point that Leopold made. So I think it'd be a fabulous standard for us to try to live up to. If only more of us did, I think the world would be a much better place.
John, in our last couple minutes, it seems like it would be easy to be pessimistic. We've got this growing demand for food with more people, concern over climate change, agriculture's impact on it, how it's going to affect our farming in the future. Having gone through the experience of researching and writing this book, do you still feel hopeful?
I am hopeful. I see some solutions out there. There are some very interesting modeling exercises done to project how much we need to change to have a positive effect on the Earth's ecosystems. Certainly, we're having a huge and mostly negative effect now. But as more and more people understand the small things they can do to make a difference, I think they will. And I'm hopeful that will generate a large change in our natural world.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
John Marsliff is professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington and the author or co-author of several books on environmental topics. His most recent is called In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. Well, as you were listening, did you think, if you are in agriculture yourself, hey, I'm doing some of the stuff we're talking about, the sustainability practices, or I'm trying to, or I want to do more of that? We'd love to hear your story. You can email us, ideas@WPR.org, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you're doing. Or if you're a consumer and you're thinking along these lines yourself, someone who eats food, again, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org.